Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. This one's a weird one. You got two old crusty dudes and two balls. Something has gone seriously wrong. Dave Warner is hanging out in my office, and we're both sitting on physio balls. So
two balls between the two of
two,
us.
Two balls between the two of us. So we're
all right.
We're seriously.
I think we've milked that deficient. About as far as we can.
Possibly. Dave, what's going on?
Oh, just the grinding away, Rob. Training people, and it's great to get down and run around in the hills with you some, and that's been pretty awesome. But
I've been taunting Dave with doing some rabbit hunting. It still hasn't happened, but we get whipped into a frenzy nonetheless. So I think folks remember Dave was on the podcast maybe about six, eight months ago with the release of MoveSkill. Dave, what's going on with MoveSkill? What's happening in the gym?
So MoveSkill.com has been up and running for 8-9 months now, and it's going great. Got signups from all over the world, and people seem to be getting some good benefit from it. So that part's good. We've been constantly working on and getting a little more polished, I guess, is the way to think of it, at our internal process, how we juggle all the different factors we're trying to juggle in the programming. And that's going better and better. So we've got a kind of a formal, nice approach to this, which is nice because then it lets us start to experiment with some different parameters, you know, work in a little bit more mobility or try some different strength protocols and just juggle some factors.
Nice.
Having a kind of a formal system, and then it lets us tinker with variables.
Cool.
That part's going really well. And we have started to run our gym, Level 4, CrossFit Seattle. We run our gym on MoveSkill programming. So we've got multiple levels of class offerings, and those, like our Level 1 class is the intermediate offering on MoveSkill, and our Level 2 class is the advanced offering on MoveSkill. So we are, I guess, kind of proofing these ideas. They're
right.
They don't exist just in an internet vacuum. They're run through quite a lot of real athletes every week, and so that part's all been going really well.
Nice. So, Dave, remind folks, because we get new folks to the podcast, and I think probably 80% of our listeners end up on an ether binge at some point, and so damage their memory and their brain cells. But so you co-founded the first CrossFit affiliate in the world, which was then CrossFit North. That eventually transitioned into Level 4 CrossFit Seattle. You had a pretty extensive movement background. You were a SEAL. You did a bunch of other physical activities, wrestling, swimming, all kinds of things. We started doing this training, really enjoyed it. But you in particular noticed some kind of holes in the game. Like, I arrived at the CrossFit scene as a power lifter and mainly a strength athlete, and had some gymnastics background, had some capoeira, had some decent powerlifting numbers. And I found my transition to be pretty seamless, you know, other than vomiting and wishing that I had died from the previous workout. But, you know, the ability to hit prescribed weights and all that type of stuff was pretty trivial for me. But we noticed a lot of holes in the game from there. And
you were definitely the first kind of light bulb moment for me, watching how you would take to the more intense CrossFit workouts and thrive with that. And I was more in a rehab state at that time, working my way through a back injury that was pretty significant. So I never was the strongest guy in the room to begin with at my best. Endurance and perseverance were more my kind of natural skill set. And so I wasn't, never been a super strong guy. And then at that point I was hurt anyhow. So I was, you know, even though you and I were working out together, I was coming at this from a very different place, using much lighter weights and often simpler versions of movements. As I recall, you already had a decent handle on the, like a pretty technically proficient clean, power clean and full clean. Whereas I was working, for instance, on just getting my front squat depth back. Didn't didn't really have that, and my whole trunk, low back area was pretty spicy at that time. So I was working carefully into just learning how to squat properly. And the overhead squat for me was, I had to start with a broom handle and really work to learn to engage my shoulders, which have been dinged up some over the years, and also keep my trunk engaged. So, and while you were, you know, maybe not setting the world on fire with your weights, but you could, you know, load a few plates on a barbell and do some decent barbell snatches,
right?
For instance. So we came at this from a different point of view, and that was my first kind of realization that you know, strength had to be pursued, you know, separately. And with your powerlifting background, it was the things that I learned working out with you were a bit different than I'd always been exposed to, more of a bodybuilding kind of flavor in the gym. You know, isolation movements and the three sets of eight, the kind of classic, medium intensity and medium volume, going more for a pump. So as the years went by, my rehab approach worked well. I was able to rehab myself, learn some movements. But I always noticed that folks that came into this with more of a strength background they would take to it sooner and progress better and have fewer problems. So it very quickly became evident that we had to do some kind of formal strength training, some kind of planned, methodical approach to strength training. And like I said, my skill set was always more the endurance side, high rep calisthenics from the military and from, you know, I grew up wrestling in the Midwest. And, you know, doing 2 hours of calisthenics was not uncommon. It wasn't unusual for me at all. And those workouts are considered hard by a lot of people, but it's not the same thing as strength, being strong. So moving on to harder movements, or adding more weight to movements, that was tough for me, and tough for everybody else that came in. And of course, a lot of folks come in with an endurance background, and they always struggle a bit and have to not just adapt their body, but shift their mindset a bit before they can really start to get some benefit out of the strength training. I think your powerlifting background was an enormous asset in that. But just over the years, I think Michael Rutherford first did this with his ME Black Box plan. He's the one that I recall
called? 2005, maybe, that he threw that out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he threw out this plan, and it was the first kind of formal working the strength training into the metabolic conditioning plan. It was the first kind of formal amalgamation of those things that I had seen.
Right.
Certainly, it's not the first time anyone's ever done it. It's just the first time that we heard of it. And it helped people. It was a good plan. So ever since then, in my practice and my gym, we've been trying different schemes to weave together these strength training elements with metabolic conditioning. And I've always found a great deal of value in body weight strength training elements. And I've noticed that folks who just strictly strength train with a barbell, it's good, you know, having a decent deadlift, having a decent squat, military press, bench press, bent over row perhaps. These are good movements and folks will get stronger and they definitely get something out of it. But for instance, you take somebody with a good back squat and then throw a workout with single leg squats at them, and they can't necessarily do that at all. So there's not necessarily a great carryover to mobility or other, you know, throw a unique variation of a movement at folks, and if they've just been doing barbell training, they won't necessarily thrive in this new movement. Whereas if you flip that around and folks have a solid background of bodyweight strength training as well, they almost always do just fine with the barbell. And, you know, I'm not really disparaging barbell training. I'm just saying it's not the only tool in the toolbox there, and we need to. So I've always found value working a combination of barbell and body weight and other tools, kettlebells, dumbbells, as strength training tools, some kind of tool agnostic, rope climb, for instance, without using your feet, using rope climb as a pulling strength development tool, for instance, is a fantastic way to build some scapular stability and upper body strength. And then from that, you get qualities that carry over to brachiation, and they carry over just fine to regular pull-ups as well.
And when we have had Chris Summer, Coach Christopher Summer on the show, he looks at the rope climb as being indispensable with developing high-level ring strength, It's kind of the gateway to get into that. Yeah.
This was something back, I'm old enough that high schools and even junior highs when I was growing up still had stall bars on the walls, still had ropes in the gyms, still had mats. There was tumbling and climbing, like every school I remember going through as a kid all had ropes. So in wrestling team practices and stuff, we'd climb rope and walk on our hands, although I never was any good at that skill. But we spend time on our hands and time on the ropes. And of course, wrestling is nothing if not a bodyweight strength pursuit. Some of those early days when Coach Summer wrote articles about using gymnastics as strength training tools, I really took that to heart. And not that we're anywhere near his level of applying those things, of course, but
just a bit of validation that there was definitely something to be learned out of that body weight kind of
avenue. Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. For instance, one of my staples of beginning upper body training for people, and this is across the board from elderly to young to middle age and super athletic to male, female, like everybody starts with at least a certain amount of horizontal pulling in the form of ring rows. At different heights, I find it easy to scale the load to an appropriate level for people. You can make it extremely hard or extremely easy, but what happens in your shoulders when you're hanging onto those rings, the way you need to stabilize your shoulders and getting this nice range of motion. It's not quite a unilateral movement, but each ring is somewhat independent, so it'll really show up weaknesses on different sides. Just as one example of taking, in a sense, that's a bodyweight strength movement, but again, it's got a lot of carryover, and that's something that I definitely got, using rings like that. I definitely got that from Coach Summers in the early days. As well as, of course, just taking a standard movement like a dip and then making it harder by doing it on the rings. There's just an awful lot of carryover on that. So in our programming, we'll program dips on parallel bars or regular dip handles. We'll program dips with added weight. And then parallel to that development, we also are programming first straight arm support and dip supports, and then dips on rings, straight arm supports on rings, then dips on rings, and eventually weighted dips on the rings as all part of this progression of upper body pushing. It's not exclusively on the rings, but the rings definitely add some complexity and some difficulty to the movement. And then again, what we get out of that is more stable shoulders that are able to, jump into new challenges better, I think, better than if we were just sticking to barbells. Barbell is a fairly stable tool. It's great in the sense you can load a lot of weight on it, and you can...
Or do micro-loading,
exactly. This incremental loading. And that's of course, the value of a barbell. But also like to use dumbbells so that each side has to stabilize and move itself without the aid of the other side. And then get on to even more unstable loading. Like, I'm not a big fan of unstable surface training, but am a big fan of unstable load training. So, and just over the years, to circle back to your question, we first realized that we had to do some formal, some methodical strength training if we were going to keep people making progress and getting the most out of the metabolic conditioning. And over the years, that's taken, I think, more and more weight. That ends, you know, your strength and your ability to apply your strength end up being the limiting factors. You can't produce, you know, great amounts of work if you can't produce force to begin with and control it. So the strength has just become certainly not the exclusive focus of our programming, but it's an important chunk of it. And we've also, over the years, had to expand our scope of strength training. In the beginning, it was squat, deadlift, military press, dips, and pull-ups, and those five movements would... that's certainly a decent start. There's some good basic foundation there, but for instance, the dips and pull-ups and military press as upper body, that's the upper body component of that list. Certainly there's a little bit of shoulder involvement, stabilizing a barbell when you're squatting, and even a little bit more when you're hanging onto a barbell for deadlifting. But military press, dips, and pull-ups, I now think are it's a decent start, but it's not sufficient for having a robust set of shoulders. All right, we need more complexity than that. So we have to add in horizontal pulling, for instance, and more straight arm work, form of handstands, planks and supports in different positions, side planks on one arm and you know, face up planks, tables, if you will, things like this. So just a lot more variety in the positions that we use, a steady foundation of straight arm strength to include just hanging and both passive and active, which I got from Coach Summers again, and a certain amount from Edo's work, Edo Portal. We found that the passive hanging as a recurring element in our warming up and cooling down, and even sometimes a little bit of a workout element in our movement classes, has really helped open people's shoulders and thoracic spine up.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time. It's not a quick intervention, but I've seen some dramatic improvements in folks' shoulders there. So I think there's a growing awareness in the certainly the body weight strength training or gymnastic strength training community of the value of just hanging.
Right.
So these elements we've had to figure out, every new thing that comes up like that, you know, here's this cool new movement, turns out it's pretty important. Now we have to figure out how to work that into a regular, because hanging, it doesn't do any good at all unless you can do it consistently, you know, or any other movement. You know, handstands, we've gotten a huge amount of value out of bringing people through a careful progression toward a handstand. A lot of scapular stability, a lot of upper body strength, a lot of thoracic opening, which is a fantastic antidote, if you will, to kind of modern culture of sitting at a desk and hunching over a keyboard. The handstand work has been a huge addition, but again, every time you get a, you know, great new idea for a fundamental piece of your strength training, you have to figure out how can I work this in to the program in a way that it comes up often enough to be meaningful, and then tinker with the variables, with the intensity and the duration and the volume of the work, and again figure out how can I, you know, put this out in a way that's going to be meaningful for folks following it.
Right.
So that's what MoveSkill does. We have, as opposed to five fundamental strength movements, it's now the number is more like 27. A lot of that is adding unilateral movements in. Some of it is adding some hip and leg, could call it supplemental work, like weighted hip bridges. Or it turns out that we need some specific, targeted work for glutes, mm-hmm. for instance. Squatting and deadlifting are great. They don't necessarily fix a problem if somebody isn't all that good at using their glutes. So we really need to do some specific glute supplemental work, call it. And again, it has to come up often enough to be meaningful. So combination of things like hip bridges and single leg squats, single leg deadlifts, unilateral work to help us sort out imbalances, and also provide a bit of a novel way to load your body. You can load, you know, one side to a pretty significant degree without taxing your axial skeleton, your central nervous system. You know, for instance, heavy deadlifting can be very draining and pull away from other types of training. So heavy deadlifting is good stuff, but if you're going to do that a lot, then you're going to be making some compromises. So that, and that's what, you know, we're trying to find this particular blend that creates what I think of as general fitness, which is, you know, I just jumped into a big mud pit there.
Right, right, statement, you know, right.
What in the world is general fitness? So I've made my definition, my understanding of general fitness known with the athletic skill levels. And finally, I know I've talked about this in the past, and it didn't come out on the time frame that I said it would, but version 2 of the athletic skill levels are out now. They're up on our level 4 or CrossFitSeattle.com. They're up on that site, and it's also the foundation of move skill. So the athletic skill levels are just some goals, goal setting tools at some different levels of call it your athletic development. So on move skill, for instance, there's a beginner level of training, and beginner assumes that you really can't do much of anything. You don't necessarily have a good push-up. You may not even be able to do a sit-up. You certainly can't do a pull-up or a dip. You are healthy, maybe overweight, but essentially there's nothing wrong with you that's sending you to the doctor, for instance. But you can't do very much athletic. So that's the assumption for beginner level of training. And then there's an intermediate level on move skill, and the assumption there is that now you can do a few push-ups, you can do some sit-ups, you can hang. You still can't do dips and pull-ups, those harder upper body weight, but we're starting to make progress with your squat, with your deadlift technique. You've got some trunk stability, some decent, just beginning to have some hip strength, hip extension strength and spine extension strength and spine stability. So we're bringing those folks through progressions of very easy preliminary steps in the body weight strength movements. I think in the end, body weight strength movements are often the hardest. You know, the Iron Cross is a obvious example here, but it doesn't have to be that elaborate. A handstand push-up, for instance, is an enormous challenge compared to, say, a military press. You can load military press up to where it's a similar type challenge, but you don't have to. You can keep military press at a very beginner level. So what we're trying to do is start folks at a real basic point in their body weight strength abilities and use a variety of tools and use some smart progressions and bring them along so that eventually we can do some really challenging body weight movements. So our intermediate level on move skill is this range of folks that can do some push-ups, they can do some ring rowing, not necessarily at horizontal, right, with their body parallel to the ground yet, but you're starting to get this some handle on body weight strength movements. Can't necessarily do pull-ups and dips yet. When you do get to the point where you can do some pull-ups and dips, now we're ready to move on into what on move skill I call advanced, the advanced programming. And again, it's advanced in the context of general fitness. So we're just talking about building a really solid foundation here. And the real idea is that these different parameters, these different measures of what constitutes general fitness, we're trying to bring them all along pretty much in lockstep, not necessarily exactly together, but we don't want to get too, for instance, you don't want to be a great runner can't do any L-sits and can hardly do a sit-up. And I actually know a number of folks who fall into that category. They can run for hours and they can't do one good sit-up. And so that's part of my both observation about what goes wrong in people's training, what leads them into chronic pain and trouble scenarios, and what limits their progress is when you get things way out of balance. Super good at a small handful of weightlifting movements, for instance, and no ability to run or do some sustained work. You've got some elements out of balance. So, you know, for details, folks can look at the athletic skill levels, or they can look at moveskill.com. There's the move skill levels, which, again, the only difference between the two is some names we've given. And on move skill, the beginner level is really what I would call pre-level one, folks that aren't actually ready to start.
Which, interestingly, both in your gym and my gym at NorCal, that's a remarkable percentage of our clientele.
Yeah.
Within this, I've talked about this stuff before, love the sport of fitness, love the CrossFit Games, think it's an amazing addition to this whole strength and conditioning story, but folks kind of get glammed by that a little bit, and they forget that the people that are really in desperate need of help, and the vast majority of the folks that are likely to populate a gym, are at a very different end of the spectrum.
Yeah, my only beef about the... I have no beef about the games. The games and the athletes that perform in the games are amazing. The tests are super legitimate tests of really kind of pushing the boundaries of human performance. I think it's fabulous. And the athletes that do that stuff are amazing. But the athletes that do that stuff are amazing. Right, they are really well-developed, very athletic people. They often come with some kind of history of some...
pretty deep development.
Pretty deep. It took them a long time to get to this point. And that's not a knock of either the system or those athletes. It's just a statement of how you get to be that kind of athlete. It takes a long time, and you have to have been doing a variety of smart training to get there. Again, I think all that stuff is pretty awesome. All the game stuff and those athletes are pretty awesome. But to your point about the folks that walk in the door of our gyms, they're not at that level. They're not close to that level. They can't even see that level from where they're standing. They're so far away in terms of their ability to feel and control their body, generate force, sustain work output, manage discomfort, and the feelings of I was going to say panic. Maybe that's a little bit too strong a word, but you can be in the middle of a really tough work set, and your body's not really coming close to keeping up with your oxygen needs, for instance. And there's some mental and emotional sensations there that take getting used to.
I would call that panic.
It can have elements of panic in it, yeah. But you have to learn how to manage this, and again, it takes time. And there's a process where folks first have to learn how to generate some force. Then they have to learn how to direct that force with some precision so they can accomplish the work they're trying to accomplish. They have to learn then to be able to sustain this force development, you know, keep it going for a while, and then manage their output, manage what's happening in their body, how it feels as you keep going. A classic example in the CrossFit world would be the workout Fight Gone Bad, where you get a few minutes into that and you've been putting out some real sustained force. And part of the magic of that workout is you're switching gears every minute. So most folks can, with a little bit of practice, can tough things out for 1 minute, and then you shift to a different exercise. So the load and the sensation change a little and allow you to kind of mentally reset. Meanwhile, your overall metabolism is still just cranking out work. So it sneaks up on folks. Sneaks up. It's a sneaky way to get in a great deal of work, which everybody who's ever done it knows, because it feels like you get run over by a truck. And that's why we all like it. But the point is, those kind of tests take some... you have to develop people to get to the point where that's a reasonable or effective thing to be doing. And like I said earlier, we've found over the years a lot of value in just paying more and more attention to how it is we're developing people's strength, bring them along. And we've found that our upper bodies and lower bodies, but especially the upper bodies and shoulders, need more complexity. That a handful of basic movements is a good start. It's better than nothing, certainly, but in the end, it's not good enough. And you know what I mean by that is that folks start to run into some chronic glitches, maybe some tendonitis or a kind of a chronic problem will come up in the shoulders or neck, upper back, elbow, wrist. You know, these kind of chronic issues come up, and the standard set of movements and some stretching is not really enough to, in many cases, it's not enough to handle that. We need more complexity. Shoulders are super complicated beasts that are capable of an enormous range of force and direction, right? And the other way to say that is they're not very stable.
Right.
They're not inherently stable. They have all this remarkable articulation. And what we need to do is develop the ability to, at a minimum, the ability for a person's shoulders to support their body weight in a variety of different positions. That's one of my kind of baseline measurements. Can your shoulders support your body weight? And it doesn't much matter if you're older or if you're younger or if you're male or female or if you're a big person or a small person. Those are your shoulders and your body, and those shoulders need to be able to support you. And some of it's really pretty basic, like a plank. Being able to hold a really active plank is a good start for a lot of folks. And if you can't do that, then trying to move on and develop a push-up, for instance, you're going to have problems. You know, and we see this often. Folks are in the middle of a push-up, and their shoulder blades have visibly shifted around on them. And I think the right way to think about that is their shoulder blades have failed. They've failed under a load. They've shifted under a load in a way that wasn't intentional. And that's a setup for, at the very least, failing to make progress. And very often, it's a setup for running into some type of chronic problem somewhere in that kinetic chain. So, you know, other examples of straight arm or just your shoulders being able to support your body weight. Hang in an active position for at the very least 30 seconds and more like a minute. Dip support in an active position, so you're not just kind of scrunched up on the rings. You're pushing your body up and holding it there with the muscles on. And again, your shoulder blades are positioned deliberately where you want them, and they're held there with the strength to do that and the stamina to do it for a little while. You know, a minute, a couple of minutes. And then, of course, moving on with a wrestling background, or I know you do jiu-jitsu, there's often times when you plant a hand, post a fair amount of your body weight on that shoulder, and pivot, move, sit out, scramble, you know, change your body position. And a lot of folks, when you slow that scenario down and you're doing some movement drills in a class, for instance, have folks post their body weight on one shoulder and then sit through. Going slowly enough to watch what happens, you'll find that very often they cannot keep their shoulder in an active engagement. So that shoulder has then failed in a really a pretty simple movement pattern. Very analogous in a sense to when you're sitting on the floor and you place one hand on the floor and start to prep yourself to get your feet under you and stand up. Shift your body weight onto that shoulder, press up a little bit. That simple test or a movement pattern stymies a lot of folks. If you slow it down enough to look at it, they cannot maintain an active shoulder engagement. So, you know, going into that by way of talking about a strength and conditioning program then for regular folks looking to get in shape has to take this stuff into account. I need to help folks build stable shoulders. And then to your point about the games and the games athletes, yeah, we want to be doing heavy weighted dips and doing it under duress when you've, you know, cranked out a bunch of other work. But for many people, there's a number of steps to get to that point. You know, first they need the stable shoulders, then they need the dip on a set of fixed handles, then they need to be able to do the dips on the rings, then we can start adding weight, and just going step by step through some progressions and in the end get to a point where we are moving toward the kind of movements that those games athletes are doing, or toward those movements and toward those loads.
Right. Dave, you guys have developed a none-to-one program, kind of trying to put some focus on this. Like, tell folks about that. It's really interesting, and before we jump into that, I've got to throw myself under the bus yet again. Both you and Michael Rutherford threw these kind of progression ideas out to me initially, and this is a great reminder about what observational bias or self bias or whatnot can bring to a topic. Michael Rutherford shot me this max effort black box kind of template, asked me what my thoughts were, doing more dedicated strength work and some progression within that, the metabolic conditioning parameters. And I was kind of like, I don't really see a need for that. And then Dave showed me this idea of kind of almost a fitness-oriented belting system that, when you reached a certain aptitude in both strength work, skill work, and capacity, that you would then kind of progress along. And the boundaries are not, diamond sharp. There's some very gray areas, just like in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, what's a blue belt versus a purple belt. There's some nuance to it, and it's not clear-cut, and age and physicality and stuff like that will kind of play into that. But I shot both of these ideas down initially because at the time I was reasonably young, had a good strength background, had a good decent movement background. And so I really downplayed the significance of these things. And now we use essentially these very technologies in our gym, and I kind of live and die by it. So just to throw myself under the bus there, but then you've taken the skill standards another step further in a way by taking the none-to-one concept and putting some really directed focus on specific things, say like a pull-up or a handstand.
So the skill levels in the beginning come from asking the question, what should a human body be able to do? And if we're looking at a particular sport, then it's fairly easy to define fairly straightforward, at least, to define what qualities does a person need, does a body need to be able to perform this sport well. But in the field of general fitness, you have to step back a little bit and ask, like, what is the larger set of movements or kind of base skills that other things are built on? A great example would be squatting. You need to be able to squat your body weight and some extra weight up and down through a full range of motion, everything from just squatting down on your haunches to have lunch or have a conversation, like so much of the world can do, but we find exceptionally difficult here in the United States. To putting a fair amount of weight on a barbell or a stone or some kind of a loaded implement, maybe a sack of grain if we're going to use an agrarian analogy there. But, put some load on us and squat up and down. Now we're creating more force through that big range of motion. So you start thinking this way and ask, what should a human body be able to do? Hang, brachiate, swing from our shoulders. It seems that our shoulders are built for this. They certainly seem to do better when we train them to do this, and so on. So you come up with a list of things, pull-ups and dips, and sometimes we will adapt the goal to a particular tool. I'd throw things like a bench press into that. It's a little bit of an artificial movement in the sense that you have this nice horizontal surface to lay on that still gives you room to move your elbows so you can get through that full range of motion with your arms. But it's a useful movement in that we can put a big load on the upper body. I find it to be part of a progression toward more what I think of as more interesting movements, like a dip, which to me has, you know, you're in the water and you need to get into a boat. So you grab the gunwale and with a dip type movement, press your body up. That seems to be a pretty common human movement pattern. So for that's where the kind of the base thinking of the athletic skill levels come from. What should a human be able to do? What happens though is people are good at different things. Some folks find that dip type motion to be very straightforward for whatever reason of growing up or the way their body's shaped. They find it pretty straightforward and easy to pull ups and dips. Other folks aren't really built for that. They might be built like a tank and they're really good at, say, grabbing a barbell and lifting heavy stuff up, picking heavy things off the ground, but they're not so good at moving their body weight around. So, you know, everybody has stuff that they're better at and stuff that they're worse at. And being humans, we tend to try to avoid the stuff we're not as good at. And I think part of this is our whole culture, too, where specialization is rewarded. The way you get noticed, the way you get ahead, the way we build our careers, the way we get our ideas noticed is to play to our strengths, to be able to identify our strengths. And I think this is both intellectual as well as physical. We, you know, if you're conducting life successfully, you've done it by identifying your strengths and then developing those strengths as much as you're able to, and therefore distinguish yourself from the crowd. Well, that's fine, but if, you know, what I'm talking about is stepping back a little bit and building a foundation. Maybe an analogy here would be like, you know, get through high school with a whatever you think of a high school education. We get that high school education before I go on and get my degree in physics. You know, like I'm going to have a certain amount of general background capability before I dive into my specialty and really go down that rabbit hole and develop myself in the narrower focus. To me, this is what the gist of general fitness is. And the problem is, folks generally don't know what their weaknesses are, don't want to know what their weaknesses are, and once you do know what your weakness is, you really don't want to work on it. It's no fun. It's no fun to suck at something. It's right. No fun to realize, like, I'm the worst person in the room at this. And then in the end, developing your weaknesses is not the way to really stand out in a crowd. It's not the way to you know, fully develop ourselves as a human. So there's a built-in resistance to what I'm trying to do. So the value then of the skill levels is putting this stuff into context to provide some goals. We do seem to thrive, I think, when we have goals. Like, humans seem to respond really well for the most part to having some goals. And if somebody can take the time to work out, you know, what's a, call it a minimal effective skill set for general fitness. And that's what I've tried to do. That's what I think the athletic skill levels are. Certainly level one is what I would call a minimal effective skill set to be a healthy adult. Not an athlete, certainly not a competitor, but you're not broken, and you can, with reasonable confidence, you know, play with your kids, take up paddleboarding, go for a hike, you know, build yourself a shed in the backyard, whatever it is people get up to. You're not broken. You don't have screwed up shoulders. You have a certain baseline of capacity. In no way does this mean you're a specialist or an expert or anything else. It's just, in my mind, like we've gotten some kind of high school competencies out of the way. But I think we need to do that up to a point. And I would say the same thing for level two. Level two is by the time somebody gets through level two, they're again not a specialist, not really impressive in any one thing, in any crowd of specialists. But you do have a pretty well-rounded athletic foundation. You can move reasonably well. You can move your body weight pretty well. You've got, you know, pull-ups and dips and some basic body weight stuff are well within your wheelhouse at this point, and you've started to dabble with some more complicated stuff like a muscle-up. And again, we're not going to impress any gymnast or any power lifters or any specialist at all, but you've got a good skill set. But again, to get, for most people to get to that point, they have to have noticed and addressed at least a couple of weaknesses. I can't really think of anybody who doesn't have something, some area that just doesn't come as easily and they have to work at it. So back to your question about none to one, what happens is if we're working along in a general program that's cycling through a bunch of different variables, then on those days when, say, for instance, an LSIT work comes up, you just groan internally and kind of get through that day and then just blank it out after that and move on. Hope it doesn't come up too often.
Right.
Because that was your weakness and you didn't want to do it and, you know, you showed up and went through the motions that day. But it's hard to make progress in that way. It's hard to make progress on your weakness without putting a little bit of extra love on that, at least for a little while, at least till you get up to, a benchmark, a goal. So with this in mind, we started developing what we call a none-to-one, a classic problem for a lot of people is being able to do a pull-up. And I think that a chin-up is, for beginners, it's the most accessible way to get that, you know, pull your body weight through that range of motion. You're going to do that. For most people, they'll find that easier to do the first few times in a chin-up, a supinated grip. So we ran a none-to-one chin-up program, and it was 12 weeks of homework, essentially, to be done 3 to 4 times in a week. For each week, we assigned a particular workout that brought people through several milestones along the way, and if they followed the plan, what was guaranteed, it's not guaranteed that everybody's going to be able to get a chin up in 12 weeks, of course, but what is guaranteed is if you do the homework for a certain week, and then at the end of the week you can do that homework with not ease but with reasonable competence, then you're ready to move to the next week of homework and so on. And if you go through the plan that way, you will get to a chin up. We're just putting some extra love on it. Unless something's wrong with your hand, shoulder, wrist, something like that. If something's wrong with you, this may not work. But if you're essentially, you know, a whole human being, or at least your shoulders, you'll be able to get to the chin up by running through the homework. And what happens is, for some folks, they'll have to circle back and do a particular week twice or three times, or they may have to put a little extra love into a certain area of development to make sure that they make that progress. And if you're not able to do the homework quite as often as we had prescribed, then maybe the whole thing takes a little bit longer than 12 weeks anyway. But it's just a planned, systematic way of looking at what kind of extra work does it take to get this one particular goal. And again, the idea here is that folks can kind of
put some real dedicated focus on that topic and...
Yeah, just grit their teeth and decide, all right, I'm going to handle this weak spot. And right now we're running... So we ran a chin-up program a couple of months ago. We've been putting this out in the form of an email. We put this out to our MoveSkill email list and our gym membership email list, and folks sign up. Have several hundred folks sign up, and we had quite a lot of folks, dozens of folks, get their first chin up, and that was great. And we'll be putting that out again and again. Right now we're doing a freestanding handstand none to one program. And this one is pretty cool because there's a lot of, shoulders are complex beasts, and there's a lot of particular little elements. Again, some people just can do it. You let them kick up a handful of times, and they're going to be able to balance on their hands. There's a lot of folks, myself among them, that there's nothing natural or automatic or easy about that skill. So, for instance, I've been able to hold my body weight on my hands and even do handstand push-ups since I was a little kid wrestling. This is a skill or a strength that I've had a long time, but the skill of controlling your midline stability and controlling the interaction with the ground through your hands and being able to actively move your shoulders around to keep things lined up and in the end have this freestanding handstand, a stable handstand. That's not easy for me and for a lot of folks. You have to work and practice. And what we found is, and I'm sure this is not news to most of the listeners, is like if you just kick up and get up on your hands and keep doing that, it's for most of us, it's not going to lead to that skill. You're not going to get it that way unless you're one of those talented folks who, basically just has it. You know, it's in your wheelhouse. You can get it automatically. Again, folks have strengths and skills that come more naturally to them. And those folks typically don't need this kind of help. But everybody else does. And the handstand, I think, is a super valuable skill. And again, I get this from a number of sources I have a lot of respect for. Coach Summers, Ido Portal, a number of folks have helped me realize. I know that in gymnastics coaching circles, little kids getting started, and a lot of martial arts programs, wrestling when I was a kid, lots and lots of, call it acrobatic, flavored pursuits will put handstands as a real staple. Like in gymnastics, this is one of the very first skills kids learn, some basic tumbling and start to learn to be on their hands. What we've found for adults who really aren't interested in martial arts or tumbling or acrobatics at all, the handstand is still a super fundamental movement with an enormous carryover. It helps, like I said earlier, it helps folks straighten out their upper back, their thoracic spine. It's a wonderful antidote or part of the antidote to our sitting, hunched over lifestyles. And it can be a lot of fun once we get past some roadblocks, and there's roadblocks for sure. So this we're right in the middle now of a none-to-one handstand program.
Nice.
And it's going well. We've got several hundred folks going through that right now, and we're getting some great feedback on that. Again, I've got plans to put out, in the end, probably at least a dozen of these none-to-one programs as kind of separate offerings in a PDF or EPUB, some kind of format like that. We're working on some layout stuff right now. I think I'm going to be rolling my first kind of packaged up, nicely laid out. We'll offer the none-to-one chin-up program. We'll offer that free. And we're in the kind of final stages of developing the layout for that. We're in those final stages now. Don't have an exact timeline, but I would think within 3 to 4 weeks we'll be ready to roll on that. And again, we're going to offer that one free. And then I think in future versions we'll charge for putting that stuff together. But the none-to-one, it's again, it's just looking at particular spots that need work, and in a real planned, methodical way, working through those.
Nice. Well, it's been a huge education for me watching Dave develop all this systemization. Again, a lot of this was largely lost on me as a coach. I saw my clients struggle with, that came into the gym that had, say, like a good, again, endurance background, general athletic background, but they had never really lifted weights, never really done gymnastics, and the usual kind of randomized approach just really wasn't getting them as far down the road as quickly as what I thought that they could, and they weren't really able to do the same things that I could do. And then it's taken some eye opening from folks like Dave and Michael Rutherford and some other folks in the community that really, helped improve me as a coach. And this Move Skill program has just been a huge boon for a lot of folks. Really encourage everyone to check that out. We will have links to that in the show notes. We'll get Dave back on here after the none-to-one programs kind of get rolled out, and we'll talk more about the specifics on that. And Dave and I have a huge stack of ribs and a bunch of meat upstairs that we need to go eat, so we're going to while I wrap this one up, anything else you can think of, Dave?
Rib roast and caffeine, and I just kind of lost my train of thought when you started talking about that. I'm kind of drooling now down. I got to wipe my chin a little bit. And
so we have other things to do, but thanks, Dave, for coming down to hang out and stalk some bunnies and also eat a lot of food.
Yeah, it was great to see you and the family, and the young one is coming up amazingly. It's always fun to check in with you guys. So, and thanks for having me on as well.
Stoked. Well, everybody, take care, and we'll talk to y'all soon.
Bye, folks.